suffered from the heartbreak of brain rot, feeling bored, sluggish, listless, not had a new idea in days, using electronic gizmos without a clue why they work? Now there's help. Ham Radio, guaranteed to stimulate your corroding neurons and open a whole new world of excitement. To learn more about Ham Radio, go to helloradio.org.
Side effects of Ham Radio usage include mental stimulation, desire for education, new career paths, understanding of technology, and cases of addiction have been reported. If you experience any of these symptoms, you're welcome.
Ham Radio, it's not your granddaddy's radio anymore.
Hello and welcome to Hacker Public Radio. Your host today is Joel McLaughlin. I am also known as Gorkin from the Linux Link Tech Show and W3RAZ or Whiskey 3 Romeo Alpha Zulu. That's how you would say my amateur radio call in phonetics, and that's what today's show is going to be about. The reason why I decided to record this for HPR was the last episode of TLLTS that we lost, we had a good conversation going with Carla Schroeder on amateur radio. And then Dan and I also rehashed as much as we could. I rehashed what I could on the subject. Now, today I'm going to cover a little bit of the history of amateur radio. And then I'm also going to basically tell you how I got interested in it, what I currently do in it, and then we'll leave it at that for this episode. But first, I just want to kind of say thanks for the guys at HPR for hosting this show, hosting the feeds here, and just thank you for giving me the opportunity to share my love of amateur radio with the listeners of HPR. So here we go. Amateur radio actually started with the birth of radio, essentially. In the beginning, there was no FCC, of course, so there was nobody to manage all that stuff. So these were basically, at that time period, that was the present-day hacker. There was no computers, there was no electronics like we have today. So they had to invent this stuff. And the inventors of, you know, people who worked on radio over the years come from the likes of Heinrich Rudolf Hertz, Nikola Tesla, Guglielmo Marconi, Amos Dobea, Reginald Fessenden, James Clerk Maxwell, Sir Oliver Lodge, Malon Loomis, Nathan Stubblefield, Alexander Popoff, and many others. Of course, also the inventors of the transistor had a huge role in how amateur radio is looking today. Now, Marconi had experiments from 1900 through 1908, and they were sending something they call continuous wave today, or CW, otherwise known as Morse code. And they used what was called a spark gap transmitter. Now, these were not the boxes like we use today at all. They looked, a little bit more, let's say brutal. They look like torture devices to me. Every time I've ever seen a spark gap transmitter, that's kind of what it looked like to me. Because essentially, a spark was actually jumping from one post to another. Anyway, so that's how, the radio first came about, is they had these they had Leyden jars, a tuning coil, a spark gap, and induction coils, and of course a telegraph key and batteries, right? And this very simple transmitter, and there's not much control of what frequency it came on in the beginning. Nothing like we have today with the computer generated displays or any of that stuff. So this is like I said, very early in amateur radio. That's how it started. And then it wasn't until 1912 that the U.S. federal government decided that it was time to start licensing amateur radio operators, which means in 2012 we will be celebrating the 100th year of amateur radio. Now, throughout the years, they actually suspended amateur radio twice. One was at least twice to my knowledge. One was during World War I, and the other was during World War II, which my grandfather served in. Now, World War II, my grandfather served as a radio officer in the army in Germany, actually. That's basically where anyone who was an amateur radio operator, they essentially went in the army. A lot of them did, anyway. So at least all the people that my grandfather hung out with, they all served as radio officers in the army. So then it wasn't until after the war and the booms of the, you know, the 50s and the into the 60s where amateur radio really started to blossom. 1961 was the first satellite carrying amateur radio. Oscar 1 was launched in 61. Ham radio also served the U.S. Navy and other Department of Defense agencies, and they would help send messages back home with the radio. So, and that actually kind of goes hand in hand with amateur radio today. We still serve the public interest in amateur radio. Usually can go in to areas and set up stations where there is very little. You know, we set up a radio, an antenna, and a generator for power or batteries or whatever. We start communicating. Think places like Joplin, Missouri, Hurricane Katrina, Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Some of these places had no communications. So I'm betting that the amateur radio operators were very, very active in those areas today even. So, and that's one of the reasons why amateur radio is important. And it's important that we get operators and that we stay at the forefront of technology. Because amateur radio operators always were there. They had to, back in the day, there was no place to go buy radios. You had to build your own. You had to go and buy a kit from Heathkit or other places like that and build your own radio. Nowadays, it's just as easy to go up to gigaparts.com and order a radio and even order antenna and feed line and everything and just put everything together. And back then, you really had to know your stuff. You had to build your own antennas. And that's one of the the things I'm hoping to accomplish with HBR is to bring some of that to the hacker community of today. Just kind of say, well, what happens if the internet goes away? How do you communicate without Skype and things of that nature and cell phones and whatnot? Well, this is how. Amateur radio is the way to get a message out of a disaster area. So how did I get interested in the amateur radio? My grandfather, as I said, he served in the World War II as a communications officer. And he was originally given the call sign W8RAZ. And then at some point where he was issued that license, which was Western Pennsylvania, that license changed from an 8 to a 3 because they did some redistricting of the call areas. Now, what do I mean by a call area? Well, basically, the FCC has a map. And depending on where you live, depends on what number is going to be in your call. Now, when I was first licensed, my call was originally N8VQJ, or November 8 Victor Quebec Juliet, in International Phonetics. And you will hear amateur radio operators use phonetics often because sometimes we're communicating in deteriorating conditions, and it's not an FM signal. You know, sideband can sound kind of bizarre if you've never heard it before. And hopefully, I might actually have a little bit of a show on each kind of rate of signal that we can produce. Of course, then you have Morse code, which that is Morse code is essentially a digital mode. It's on and off, kind of. You either have a signal or you don't. That's where digital binary stuff first came from, Morse code, when you really think about it. So my grandfather was originally W8RAZ. Until the redistricting, then he was W3RAZ. Now, in a lot of areas, all the different variations on the call signs have been issued. And they're starting to recycle them. The original call signs used to be like 1x2s. Like, I have a friend who's got a call at N8 XE. So those are starting to be reissued because, well, the people who used to hold them are dying. So they have to give new people call signs from somewhere. So that's what happens. So, so when I pass on, if my son doesn't get my current call sign W3RAZ, somebody else will. So now my hope is that somebody else gets it, because W3RAZ has always been in my family since my grandfather. That's one of the reasons why I switched my call sign. Back in 2003, I finally went to the effort to learn Morse code and take the test, and I passed my 13 words per minute Morse code test. Now, unfortunately, I probably can't send or receive that anymore. But that's just the way it was back then. Back in 2003, I had to do that. Now, 3 years later, they got rid of the requirement. So, oh well. That's just the way it happens. But so it was at that time when I upgraded my license. I had, it was kind of funny. I had already told my my friend Carl Deaver, AA8YY, or Alpha Alpha 8 Yankee Yankee. I told him that I was going to go ahead and change my call once if I passed my exam. And that year I decided I was going to take my exam at the Dayton Hamvention in 2003. And the great thing with the way ham exams are now is that you'll walk out knowing and able to use your new privileges that you just earned. That's the way it works. I walked in and passed my exams. When I came out, he asked me how I did, and I said, I passed. And he handed me a name tag with my new call on it already. Now, now I had to turn in paperwork to the FCC to get that, because it was actually available. And fortunately enough for me, nobody else wanted it. So I was able to pick it up, and fortunately I didn't have to go destroy that tag. That's kind of how I got my call sign upgraded. And why did I get into it? Well, it's my grandfather. My grandfather was a big influence in my life. I always hung out with him. And we talked on the radio when we were kids with his friends. And we, you know, to me, it was just fascinating to sit there and watch him talk into the radio and he be heard thousands of miles away. And so that's kind of what inspired me to go get my license. And my grandfather always knew that if anyone was going to do it, it would have been Joel. So that's also where I got my love for computers and all the rest of the stuff that makes me what I am today. So amateur radio is a lot of what makes me up, or what makes me up. What modes do I work now? I primarily do FM. I use a heavy handheld radio. I use a Yaesu VX7R, which is that's what they call a tri-bander handheld radio. It has 6 meters, 70 centimeters, 2 meters, and it doesn't do 220, but it does receive like broadcast band and stuff like that. Plus, I can receive all the way up to you know, other bands too. I think you can receive some of the HF bands on there as well. And so that's my handheld radio I use. I also have a radio that I inherited from my grandfather, made by a company called Asden. Now, Asden doesn't make amateur radios anymore, but they do make microphones and PA equipment still, so they're still around. And that radio is a Asden PCS 6000, and that's 2 meter only. It's got a keypad on the microphone for using DTMF tones. DTMF is basically, if you know what your phone, like your cell phone, if you ever hear the tones that come from that, that's what they call a DTMF tone. And I'll talk a little bit more about that maybe in a later HPR. But so in that's my two primary radios. I also have an HTX-10, I believe it is. It's a 10-meter only radio that I picked up from Radio Shack for $50. You're not going to get that lucky twice. most radios that I've seen, you might have seen, you know, it can cost anywhere between $500 to thousands of dollars for the radios. But you can still actually build your own radio today. It's a little harder, maybe, than it used to be. And it's, in some cases, it's easier because back then you had to have things like an oscilloscope and stuff like that. But in a lot of cases nowadays, you don't even have to have an oscilloscope. You can just use what they call a VOM or volt-ohm meter to do the necessary measurements when you're putting the radio together. Now, I actually have not put any of these together myself yet. Maybe someday I might buy one and just learn how to do it. But there's all kinds of kits that you can buy still. They're just a little harder to find. You just can't go to Radio Shack and buy parts to build your own radio now like you used to be able to. But it's still possible to build your own radio. There's also other things like software-defined radios, which, you know, I've never used myself, but I know they exist. And that's part of what you have to learn when you, you know, you may not have to learn about software radios necessarily for your test, but you have to learn certain things about what amateur radios do, operators do, the law a little bit, you know. And so, for example, one part of the law is you're not supposed to use any more power than is necessary to establish communications. That is, you don't go around full legal limit all the time just because you can. You use only what you need to establish communications. Now, there's some amateurs that go into that a little bit deeper and run as little as they can. And those operators are called what they call QRP operators. QRP is a Q code for low power. Most of these operators probably run 5 watts or less. And you can work the world with a radio that only produces 5 watts. You don't need hundreds and thousands of watts to establish communications on a worldwide basis. But that's what some people think they're supposed to do, but that's really the antithesis of amateur radio. So, that's really all I'm going to have in this episode, because I want to pick some certain topics out specifically and record some shows, other shows about it. Like, one of the things I want to look at is radio programming. For many years, since like the late 90s, at least, I think, you've been able to hook your radio up to a computer and program them. That way you don't have to sit there and type into a little tiny keypad to program all the frequencies that you might want to use. So I'll cover a little bit on that, and not necessarily on how to do it with the out-of-the-box stuff, but how to do the more hackery kind of things. How to do that in Linux, for example. So those are the kind of topics I hope to get in here on Hacker Public Radio. I hope you find this topic interesting. If you want to email me suggestions, feel free to email me. Gorkin@TLLTS.org is one address you can use, or you can also use my Gmail address, which is the same. Gorkin, G-O-R-K-O-N, @gmail.com. And thank you guys for listening to this. I hope you, like I said, hope you find it informative, and I hope it really interests you in amateur radio. And that will also be, I keep thinking of topics as I'm talking here, so I'm going to go ahead and stop recording here. But like I said, hope you found it interesting, and stay tuned to Hacker Public Radio. Hopefully I can get some more of you interested into amateur radio. Now, before I leave, if you're going to the Southeast Linux Fest, one thing I am definitely going to do is I'm going to take my amateur radio with me. And if I can get a show out, well, I don't know if this is going to run before self, because it's only in a couple weeks here. But if you're out there and you're in the Spartanburg area, I highly suggest looking up Jeremy Sands, who's one of the organizers of the Southeast Linux Fest. He has a nice set of frequencies that you can use with the amateur radio to communicate in that area. So if you're an amateur radio operator and you would like to talk to me, W3RAZ, just give me a call. I'll probably listen to probably the very first frequency in Jeremy's list for a little bit of time every day. So I might even try and establish a net, maybe. I don't a self-net. I don't know. we'll see. The thing is I'm going to also be there in service of the Linux Link Tech Show. So I'll be at the Tech Show booth. And I may take the radio with me right at the booth. So you can take a look at it. If you've never seen an amateur radio, you can take a look at my radio. And we can chat about amateur radio. So one thing that I'll share with you as I close the show, and it seems like I've been closing for 5 minutes, is there's a set of codes that you will hear operators use. Now, a lot of the operators use them in voice modes, but a lot of, you don't really have to, but I usually do at the end of my own personal podcast. I'll use the term 73, and 73 means best regards. So I wish everyone a 73s. Have a happy summer. Hopefully I can see you at the Southeast Linux Fest in Spartanburg, South Carolina. And give me a call. Call signs W3RAZ and 73s, and I'm clear.
With over 220 people dead and a path of destruction hundreds of miles long, survivors of the Alabama tornadoes found themselves in whole cities without power, telephones, internet, cell phones, or other ways to communicate. And who is there to help in this devastation? The amateur radio operators. Ham radio people are providing communications between shelters, relief centers, emergency operations centers, search and rescue groups, and a host of relief organizations as they respond to the crisis. In the days to come, more hams will arrive from around the country to be assigned where they're needed most. These unpaid volunteers are using their radio skills to get critical voice and digital messages through. When other systems go down or are overwhelmed, ham radio people using modern equipment still are reliable like they always have been. To learn more about amateur radio in emergencies, go to emergencyradio.org.
Thank you for listening to Hacker Public Radio. For more information on the show and how to contribute your own shows, visit hackerpublicradio.org.